Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 287 for October 31st, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
The best whiskey I tested this year, I think it was a rum.
Okay.
No, I'm joking.
That's the one and only Serge Valentin, the man behind WhiskeyFun.com, one of the leaders of the Malt Maniacs, and, to be honest, one of my whiskey mentors. We finally got the chance to sit down for a chat recently at Whiskey Live Paris. You'll hear the entire conversation in a few minutes, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, this week's ForScotchLovers.com trivia question, the holiday gift guide, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news, brought to you by Glenmorangie. Glenglassaugh marks the second anniversary of its reopening over the next couple of weeks, and its older whiskies are finally going to be available in the U.S. The distillery was mothballed between 1986 and 2008, and Stuart Nickerson has been looking through the warehouses for older casks to release. While they've been available for the last year or so in Europe and Canada, U.S. red tape has held them back until now.
Taken some time, mainly because of just getting the labels approved, and that just seemed to take an inordinate amount of time. And we're having the same problems trying to get the spirit drinks approved. Things seem to go in and then just take quite a long time to come back out the other end.
And the spirit drinks, for those who aren't aware, that's the drinks like the spirit that shall not be named and the spirit that blushes to speak its name that you and I have spoken of before.
That's correct. That's all the younger than 3 year products we've got. We now have four in that range, two brand new spirits, one which is peated and one which is unpeated, both clear spirits, and then the one that's 6 months old from red wine casks, and now we have one that's 12 months old from an ex-bourbon cask. So we're just extending the range, and people can now appreciate what happens in terms of maturity in the first few months and subsequently years of life of, shall I say, spirit before it becomes whiskey.
And those are available in Europe, as we know now, but yeah. I know you're hoping at some point to get those into the States, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Really very keen to get them in later on over the next few months, and we are working and we've got our labels in for approval, and it'll just take a bit of time until it gets here.
Let's talk about the releases that are coming to the U.S., because these are older Glenglassaughs that were produced long before the distillery shut down in 1986, right?
That's right, yeah. These are our old ones, which the youngest one is 26 years of age. And it was produced way back in 1983 now. It's actually a blend of a number of refill hogsheads put together, about 10 refill hogsheads put together to come up with this and reduce to 46%. But like everything else, it's non-chill filtered, non-colored, and we bottle everything on site. So I think it's a great drink. We did have it packaged as a 21-year-old previously, even though it was much older. And what we've done is we've put the appropriate age on the label, because it was 26 years, but well, by now it's almost 27 years, shall we say. And then we extend our range, and we go to our aged over 30 years, which is a single cask bottling, and it's a 34-year-old product. Single cask, again, it's a refill, similar to the rest of the Glenglassaugh range. It's elegant, it's sophisticated, very, very complex. And it comes in a crystal glass decanter and the wooden outer package. And it's just a great packaging, absolutely fabulous product. And I think it would end very, very well in the States.
And then you have the older than 40 year as well, right?
And then we have the older than 40 years as well, as you say. And that one there is a 41-year-old coming in at 44.6% alcohol.
Wow.
Another one, great product, comes similarly in the decanter and the wooden box, this time with a couple of crystal glasses as well. Much more sherry influence in this one than there is with the 30-year-old. But it just happens to be the cask, because each one is an individual cask. No reduction in the case of the individual casks. They are completely as they come out of the wood at the end of the day in terms of strength. Again, fabulous products. And I suppose the one good thing about the job that I'm doing at the moment with Graham and Ronnie Rutledge, who's joined us, is the fact that we get to choose all these casks and make the final decision as to what we release, and it gives us lots of opportunity to keep tasting them.
And
then finally, probably what I'm really very excited about is the Rare Cask Series. It's a triple pack which contains a 26-year-old, a 37-year-old, and a 43-year-old, but all 200 mils. And because they're 200 mils, then it makes it more affordable to have that triple pack than to buy an individual large bottle of the older expressions. You know, it comes in a leather case, all three together with the tasting notes, and side by myself. Again, the 37 and 43-year-old are individual casks, so they're at cask strength. The 26-year-old is part of the 26-year-old that you can buy in the 700 mils, so it's 46%.
The other thing you're doing, and let's go back to that period in 1986 for a second with the 26-year-old, is that you're actually going back and honoring the previous distillery managers back before the 1986 closure with the Manager's Legacy releases, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Manager's Legacy release came together because we, I suppose, just from one of those conversations where you're saying, you know, we had some really good managers before, people I personally knew because I worked with Highland at the time of the closure. And they put a lot of time and effort into creating Glenglass and New Spirit and laying it down in cask. At least one of the previous managers, Jim Cryle, who was also a manager at Glenlivet subsequently and became their master blender, Jim helped us with some of the historical information. And it just seemed like a good idea to have release four different cask releases over a six-month period, and each one honouring the person that laid the new spirit down at that time. And so therefore what we've created is a Manager's Legacy release. I'm afraid it is only in 700 ml bottles, very, very restricted, and it gives a small story about the manager on the back of each bottle. So, for instance, a Jim Cryle bottle is restricted to only 200 bottles. There's only 200 bottles worldwide of a 1974 refill hogshead, which celebrates Jim's time in charge. For Dodd Cameron, there's a refill butt where we managed to get 500 bottles from the refill butt, and that's a 1986 refill butt that celebrates Dodd's time in charge. And there's two older releases, which date back to the 1960s for Bert Forsyth, and prior to that, Walter Grant.
And those last two will be coming out after the first of the year, right?
They'll be coming out in 2011, yes. They are slightly more expensive again, but not as expensive as our existing 30- and 40-year-olds. We've tried to make them a bit more affordable this time by packing them into standard tall-round bottles and in a cardboard tube with, you know, a bit of the story and everything, but the packaging is not what it is for the normal range.
And the Dodd Cameron release comes out in November, correct?
It's coming out in November. In fact, I can tell you we have almost finished the bottling today. So it is ready to roll, and the first order I know is going to be shipped to Germany within the next few days.
Distribution issues mean the U.S.-bound Glenglassaugh will only be available at first in California, Missouri, Tennessee, Kentucky, Massachusetts, and Illinois. I'll have tasting notes for them on a future episode of WhiskeyCast. Last winter, distillery warehouses in Speyside crumbled under the weight of tons of snow, but in the whiskey equivalent of using the lemons you're given to make lemonade, Glenfiddich is releasing a special limited edition using some of the casks from its damaged warehouses. Maltmaster Brian Kinsman decided to turn those casks into Snow Phoenix. The name comes from the scene as spotlights lit up the damage at night while Glenfiddich crews were digging out the casks. Part of the proceeds from the sale of Snow Phoenix will benefit the Cairngorm Mountain Rescue Team. 1,000 bottles will be available to Glenfiddich Explorers Club members, and the rest will go on sale in duty-free and selected markets during November. Now, it also makes a perfect tie-in to the new Glenfiddich One Day You Will ad campaign, with an emphasis on exploring new challenges. Brian Kinsman and I discussed it at an event to kick off the campaign this past week in New York City.
We believe we are a really innovative whiskey company, and obviously my role in the company is all about the liquid, but it's how do you turn it into something inspirational for, you know, for other people to be part of outside just tasting the whiskey.
With the new campaign, what's the new focus for Glenfiddich?
Absolutely pioneering. You know, it's as a company, going back through the company's history, you know, William Grant, his family, the very first single malt to be exported, the all through our time there's been, we believe, exceptionally pioneering for us and for the category, and it's really just starting to focus on that and be open and honest about it and say that, you know, that we're proud of where we've come from, we're really ambitious about where we're going. So
one thing I did not get to talk to you about a couple of weeks ago when we were together in Paris was the new Rich Oak bottling, right, which was your first Glenfiddich expression,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, now we'd worked on it throughout last year. In fact, we'd been working it off and on for a while. But yes, it came out this year, very much a focus on finishing in virgin oak, uniquely, innovatively using Spanish, so virgin Spanish oak. We've used virgin American oak before. Other people have done that too. I don't believe anybody's used essentially a sherry butt that's never held sherry before, and we're really, really pleased with the results in terms of just the flavour development.
Where is it available?
It will be available globally. Right now, the first market was the UK, so the UK and France are the two lead markets. I think beyond that, it will gradually go out to everybody.
Now, a question that I often get when I talk to you and your colleagues from other companies at events like this is, who's minding the store when you're out here on the road? Who's making sure that the blends get put together properly and that all the hard work gets done back at home?
Yeah, well, we've got a great team at home, and so there's guys there doing that. Ultimately, I can do quite a lot from here. I can do a lot of remote access. I can make sure that things are happening. I can set things up. We've got nosing panels, making sure day-to-day all works, and then when I get back, it's a catch-up job, you know, just try and make sure we catch up with everything, make sure everything's gone well, and then prepare for the next one.
And you can't nose from here, and that's the only drawback, right?
Yeah, that'd be a pretty neat app on the iPhone, I guess, but, you know, one day maybe.
And that is something we'll be considering for a future version of the WhiskeyCast iPhone app, way in the future. Now, you might have seen this next story coming for 20, 30 years or so. Rob Samuels was named Chief Operating Officer of Maker's Mark this past week. He's the son of Bill Samuels, Jr., and has been working his way up through the marketing side of the family business. He most recently served as Director of Global Brand Development. Rob's grandfather and Bill's father, Bill Samuels, Sr., founded Maker's Mark in 1953. Rob is the eighth generation of the Samuels family to work in the whiskey business. He'll also serve as general manager of the Maker's Mark Distillery. And by the way, Bill Jr.'s not going anywhere. He remains president of Maker's Mark, which operates as a semi-independent unit of Beam Global Spirits and Wine. Back in May, the Fagiel series featured some of the highlights from the first ever Friends of Lafroy gathering at the distillery on Isla. Next Monday, a handful of green welly-clad Friends of Lafroy will be invading another island, Liberty Island in New York Harbor. While they won't be painting the Statue of Liberty Lafroy green, Lafroy's Simon Brooking expects a party nonetheless.
A lot of it's been prompted by the Isla Whiskey Festival gathering that we had this summer. We had such a great response. All over the world we had people having gatherings at the same time as we were doing it on Isla. And so we decided to do something for the week of Whiskey Fest in Manhattan. Originally we were looking at Times Square, but ever since a gentleman tried to blow the place up, security's very high there. So we were looking at some place that's rather iconic and unique for Friends of Lafroy to gather at. And so we thought about the Statue of Liberty, Liberty Island. There's some interesting parallels, I think. You know, you have to take the ferry to Liberty Island the way you do to Isla. And John will talk about that. And certainly, it's interesting to see for us, the friends that are gathering for that, the diversity, the where everybody's coming from. It really shows the diversity of Friends of Lafroy globally, it's just to claim our own piece, our own square foot of Liberty Island, which we can, you know, we can rename Isla Liberty Island if we'd like. I think we need to put in the bay there maybe a smaller version of the Statue of Liberty there, holding a bottle of Lafroy in her hand for all travelers as a beacon of hope.
Now, what exactly is going to happen? You're taking 50 people from the New York Marriott Marquis out to Liberty Island, right?
Yep, we're going to gather and have a sip of whiskey along the way and get a photograph of all of these Friends of Lafroy at the Statue of Liberty there. There's some historical precedent for Scots in New York, and we'll talk about that on the trip over. Some folks from Isla. I don't want to give it all away because I think there's some connections between New York and Isla that run very deeply. So it's all about bringing it all together over a good dram or two.
The 50 people were selected by email, and it was the first 50 to respond. I have to ask, how quickly did those first 50 emails come in?
It very quickly. We've been getting a lot of responses from the Friends of Lafroy gatherings, and it's been overwhelming. There was a point where we were talking about, well, do we want to expand it to a larger group? But we've decided to keep them smaller because it's more intimate. We want to be able to spend time with all the people who come to these events. You know, we could open it up to 300, 500 people and easily fill it for Friends of Lafroy. We've been getting that kind of response. But I think it's important that we keep it smaller so that we can spend that time with the people who show up. It's regrettable that not everybody can come to this event, but we're planning on doing more events and hoping that people can come to those. So you just have to act quickly, and then we'll see at the events.
Less than an hour, huh?
Less than an hour. It's fast, you know, with the internet anymore. If you're not on it right away, it will move quickly. And that speaks to the power of the whiskey itself. You know, when we did the Lafroy Live from Jerez in Spain, we had 40,000 people watching live online just at that event from all over the world, from Bulgaria, from Australia, from New York, from Spain. And it was really exciting to get the global perspective with the whiskey as well.
The gathering takes place Monday, November 8th, and I'll be tagging along for the festivities. Listen to that weekend's episode for details. Whiskey Life hits South Africa this coming week with a stop in Cape Town, and South Africa is getting a Jameson Irish whiskey of its own. Jameson Select Reserve uses a special small batch run of triple distilled grain whiskey that's blended with single Irish pot still whiskey. South Africa was picked to debut the new expression because the country has shown a 24% increase in Jameson sales over the last decade. However, I've been told it may eventually be released in other markets as well. Another Irish whiskey will be far more widely available soon. Michael Collins is being relaunched with new packaging and an age statement for the first time. Abigail Hendren of Michael Collins owner Sydney Frank Importing told me the changes make Michael Collins more historically relevant.
What we've done is two things. We've gone back to a very old school traditional Irish whiskey bottle, really to sort of honor the past, not only of like Michael Collins and his time, but also the past of Ireland and our long history in making Irish whiskey. And then what we've done is we've really stepped up the impact of the label. We have a really strong story to tell about Michael Collins and our points of difference. So you'll see all of the key elements on the label, whether it's the fact that we're made at the last independent distillery that's Irish owned, the fact that we're double distilled, the fact that our single malt is a 10-year-old, the fact that it's lightly peated. There's just a lot of information on the label that really tells a better story about the brand.
And the single malt is now a 10-year-old as opposed to a no-age statement.
Correct. Whenever we first launched Michael Collins, we didn't have enough 10-year-old. So it was, on average, in the bottle, it was 10 years old, but there was some 8-year-old in there. So we now have aged enough 10-year-old that we're able to step up the product to a 10-year-old.
And the blend remains the same, though, right?
Blend is exactly the same. It's just a new package. And the single malt will be available. Our official launch date is now the 15th of January next year.
And it'll be available nationwide?
Yes, that's our plan.
And I'm seeing this in more international markets, too. I actually saw it in Ireland when I was over there in the duty-free stores.
In the duty-free store in Dublin?
And at the bar at Castle Martyr.
That's what I like to hear. In the old bottle, though. So we are a bit behind in Ireland. It'll not be until next year that we are able to switch over.
That last part is important for a reason. If you dig back into the Whiskey Cast archives all the way back to March of 2006, when I talked with John Teeling of Cooley Distillery, where Michael Collins is produced, he told us back then the original plans were to only sell the brand in the U.S. But since that time, demand within Ireland has been strong enough to make it available there as well. And that's the news. Brought to you by Glenmorangie, handcrafted by the 16 men of Tain since 1843. Now let's look at the emails of the week, brought to you by the Singleton of Glendullen. Got an email the other day from Christopher Winters after I mentioned that I've started blogging on some non-whiskey topics. Dear Mark, I like the idea that you just started your blog about other ideas beyond whiskey. Great idea. You got me thinking about other things aside from everyone's love of whiskey that listens to your podcast. I thought you might want to discuss literature also and possibly as it relates to scotch. I'm part of a Scotch Drinkers book club. It's a group of six guys who read and discuss a book every 6 to 8 weeks. It's been going on for over 10 years. I've been a part of it for the past 3.5 years. I find it is a great source of camaraderie, and we have all become very close friends through the years. I thought your readers might want to know about our club, but maybe they would be inspired to start one of their own. One person always hosts the event, and we taste one bottle of a single malt scotch. A few blends may have snuck in, and I'm actually pushing for that. And we taste it blind and then rate it. We use 0 to 5 and can have half points. I've been pushing for the quarter point system, but always get shot down. You can see a list of what we have tasted and each rating by each person through the years. We each also pick a book, and that person is in charge of leading the discussion, but usually it ends up with our true leader, the professor, who always comes well prepared. I seem to be the authority on the Scotch end since I have the largest collection and am quite passionate about Scotch whiskey. Anyway, here's the website that you might want to share with your listeners. In fact, the book I'm thinking about suggesting for my next selection is The Whiskey Rebellion by William Hoagland. I haven't picked my next single malt selection for the club. The website is http://www.scotchdrinkersbookclub.com. Thanks, Christopher. By the way, that website is all one word, scotchdrinkersbookclub.com, and I'll put a link on the WhiskeyCast website to the club. I think it's a great idea. As soon as I have time to actually sit down and read a book, I'll probably blog about it. Now, I ran into some listeners Friday night at the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Single Malt Extravaganza in Philadelphia. One of them was Angelo Veneziano, who just happens to live near me in New Jersey, and sent this email earlier in the week. Just finished listening to your 1024 podcast. Great episode, by the way. And for whatever reason, my iPod won't reboot. Could it be suffering from alcohol poisoning? I'll try a Restore at home. In the meantime, I'll let it get over its hangover. Wish me luck. Well, Angelo reported his iPod has completely recovered from its hangover. I also ran into Brian Strike, who posted this Saturday on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. It was nice to meet you last night, Mark. I had a great time tasting a number of whiskies that I've been reluctant to invest the money in for an entire bottle. The big surprise for me was the Suntory Yamazaki 18. It was outstanding and is definitely a must-buy. One gentleman I kept running into all evening asked me which one I was surprised to like. When I said the Yamazaki 18, he agreed that he was surprised by it as well, but would never buy any because he was a purist and would never buy any whiskey not made in Scotland. I thought, great, more for me. Ha! Cheers to you. Please keep us informed of events in the Philadelphia area. Will do, Brian. It was great to meet you as well. And to those purists who will only drink Scotch whiskey, you're really missing out. I'd like to ask a favor of you. After 5 years of producing WhiskeyCast, it's time to find out more about you and the audience. I've created the first ever WhiskeyCast listener survey. You'll find a link at the WhiskeyCast website. And I'd appreciate it if you'd take a few minutes to answer some questions anonymously for us. It'll help us with some ideas for improving the show in the future. Of course, you can still email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by the Singleton of Glendullen, 12-year-old Speyside single malt Scotch whiskey, aged in both American bourbon oak and European sherry oak casks. Let's answer last week's ForScotchLovers.com trivia question now. I wanted the name of the unique charcoal mellowing process used in Tennessee whiskeys Jack Daniel's and George Deckel. Had more wrong answers than usual this week, including a few who just said charcoal mellowing. But it's officially known as the Lincoln County process. Dustin Harvey got it right. His answer was selected at random from all of the correct answers to win the $50 gift certificate from ForScotchLovers.com. Now here's this week's question. Farmers in Scotland used to hide their whiskey from the excisemen by storing it in barrels labeled as something for their livestock. This heritage is reflected in the name of one whiskey being sold today. Name the whiskey. You can submit your answer at the ForScotchLovers.com website. One word, ForScotchLovers.com/WhiskeyCast. And there's a link at the WhiskeyCast website, too. I'll have the holiday gift guide in a few minutes. But if you're looking for a place to buy whiskeys as gifts, just use the promo code WhiskeyCast on your first order at ForScotchLovers.com, and you'll get free FedEx ground shipping. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. First off, tickets go on sale this week for the Victoria Whiskey Festival in January in British Columbia. Check the festival website for details. This festival will sell out this coming weekend. This coming Thursday night, there's an American whiskey tasting to benefit autism research at O'Connell's in Jersey City, New Jersey. Brook Laddie's Jim McEwen will be the guest of honor at a tasting with F. Paul Packolt the same night at Keene's Steakhouse in New York City. And Jim will have an event at the Astor Center the next night in New York as well. Of course, Malt Advocates sold out Whiskey Fest New York is the 9th. There are plenty of tastings and special events going on all week long. Anthony Wills of Kilhoman will have tastings on the 10th in the Milwaukee area. And finally, Glasgow's Whiskey Festival takes place November 13th at the Arches. You'll find links and a complete list of events at the WhiskeyCast website. And it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay. Time now for the WhiskeyCast Holiday Gift Guide, brought to you by Isle of Jura. It was just one of the many whiskeys being poured Friday night at the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Single Malt and Scotch Whiskey Extravaganza in Philadelphia. The U.S. chapter of the Society holds these tastings around the country during the spring and the fall, in addition to members-only tastings as well. I talked with U.S. Chapter President Alan Shane about the benefits of a gift membership in the Society.
If one is a whiskey lover and they're looking to expand their horizons in single malt Scotch whiskey, the Society offers very rare and unique single cask single malts from virtually every distillery in Scotland. One of the best parts is that all the whiskeys are chosen through our tasting committee, a group of independent tasters who taste the whiskeys blind, not knowing how old they are or where they come from. If all agree on the quality of the whiskey, we buy it. Any of them don't like it, we take a pass. and we turn away about 80% of all the single casks that are offered to us.
And there are other benefits as well as being able to buy these exclusive single casks.
Absolutely. We have two members' rooms in Edinburgh that our members are welcome to spend time at and stay over. We have a members' room in London as well. We're hoping to open our first members' room in New York early in 2011. Members are also invited to attend our tasting events throughout the country. When one becomes a member, every 3 weeks they're sent a publication called Outturn, which is the Society's bottling list of the whiskeys that we bottle for that period. Every 3 weeks, we offer 5 new single malts to our members. They're also given our Society magazine called Unfiltered, because all of the Society whiskeys are unfiltered whiskeys, non-diluted. And it's just a fun group. Members get together on a regular basis, enjoy each other's company, camaraderie, and enjoy pretty much the finest whiskeys that are available out there.
And there are chapters in about 7 or 8 countries, right?
There are chapters, I believe, in close to 13 countries now. We just opened up India. We've opened up Taiwan. We've opened up Russia this past year. We're expecting to open up about 3 or 4 more countries next year. And we're pretty much in every country in Europe. We're in Japan. We're a pretty international group. We have about 35,000 members throughout the world currently.
And I can't let you go without talking about the members' rooms in New York City. What's planned here? What can you discuss at least?
Well, we're in negotiations with a private club down around the Wall Street area. Beautiful old building dating back to the late 1800s. And we're negotiating to take space for a members' room in there that'll have a members' bar where members can come, enjoy the Society whiskeys, enjoy wonderful cuisine as well. And if all goes well, we should be able to announce it officially sometime around the first of the year.
The next extravaganza is November 16th in San Francisco, and you'll find a link to the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's website in the gift guide at the WhiskeyCast website. I'll have another gift idea next week. Of course, the gift guide is brought to you by Isle of Jura, in a world of its own. Serge Valentin doesn't take many things seriously, and if you need evidence of that, just visit his Whiskey Fun website. It's one of the world's most popular whiskey websites, and Serge's tasting notes are among the most respected anywhere. As I said at the start of this episode, I'm proud to consider Serge as a mentor, and we sat down recently to talk at Whiskey Live Paris.
I wanted to ask you, first off, how you got into whiskey in the first place, years and years ago, because you've been doing Whiskey Fun for so long. How did you get into single malt scotches and other whiskeys?
Well, there's been several stages, of course. The first one was a long time ago. I think it was in the early 80s or even the late 70s. It was my first trip to Scotland. And, of course, we visited the distillery with the Highlanders and the kilts and the bagpipes. At the time, it was still very old style, and of course we loved it. And then I met a guy who had some Glenfiddich, and this was the new stuff at the time. So that was my first single malt I remember. The only problem is that he really drowned it with a ginger ale, so it was funny. But then there's been a long period of, you know, a whiskey, a nice single malt from time to time, and then I met a good friend of mine, which is Marc Renier from now Bruichladdich, but at the time he had a nice shop in London that was called La Réserve, and one day he organized a huge tasting session with a lot of Springbanks. I remember it was probably in the late 80s, and that was really the start of it.
And how did you go from this, from drinking it, to writing about it for Whiskey Fun? Because you have probably scored more whiskeys than almost any other whiskey writer or whiskey critic. How did you go from that to creating Whiskey Fun?
You know, it's the kind of thing you do for the first time one day, and and then you spend your whole life regretting that you did it. You know, you just can't stop. A blog is like a mistress, you know. Sometimes you think you shouldn't have started. You should have broken a leg on that very day. But anyway, I don't know. It was just at the time I met the Malt Maniacs, you know, and Johannes and these guys. And Johannes was already very active on the web. So I said, well, let's do a tasting diary on the web, just for fun. It wasn't a blog at the time, and it's still not a blog, really, because blog engines didn't exist, by the way. So you just had to do everything by hand, HTML, and that's what I still do. But
and it has progressed to the point where you have literally notes for thousands of whiskeys on the site, right?
Yeah, I think there must be something between 6,000 and 7,000, yeah, different tasting notes, yeah, for different whiskeys, yeah.
This puts you in a unique position to sort of discuss the changes we've seen in the whiskey industry over the years. What have we seen, both good and bad, over the last 10, 15 years in the whiskey business?
I think the good and the bad are the same thing. Probably the fact that, on average, all whiskeys are better, which means that you have much, much less crappy whiskeys, like we saw 10 years ago. Some guys would just bottle, you know, any single cask, and some were really crappy, and some were absolutely fantastic. And I think today, all the new whiskeys are all very good, but maybe you don't find fantastic ones anymore, and you don't find crappy ones either. So what's good is that the general level got really better, thanks probably to better wood management, or wood technology, as they say in Scotland. That means usually using very active casks. An active cask is a good cask for a Scotsman, you know, because it's quick.
Right.
So it gives a lot of vanilla, ginger, honey to the spirit, which is good, but which may erase all the differences. And I'm not too sure that in the future, when we'll try some 10-year-old Space Hider, we will be able to make a difference between two distilleries. This is my concern.
Everybody's whiskeys are tasting almost the same these days, and it really takes a discerning nose to be able to pull out those differences, right?
Actually, I'm not quite sure it's possible. You can do, like, if it was possible, you can say it is possible, but it's very tricky, you know, when you have a lot of vanilla on a whiskey, on a scotch, and on a young scotch, what we call a modern whiskey. I don't know if it's the proper term. I think it's quite difficult to get them. Of course, when you see the label, you instantly recognize it when you know that it is this or that brand. But when you don't know, when you taste it blind, it's very tricky.
Where do you stand on finishes?
I think finishes were probably a good way of selling or of improving so-so whiskies that were distilled in the probably late 70s or in the 80s, because they were, you know, there was the whiskey lake that created these huge problems that forced some groups to close some distilleries and so on. At the time, the spirit was probably not that good. Maybe the wood wasn't that good either. And I think it was a good thing to put this rather, not bland, but sort of average whiskey into, for instance, wine casks, because it gave some individuality to the whiskey. But I'm not quite sure it will go on. I don't know if they will keep using them. Some do it very well. Some, I don't know, my taste is not too much towards these whiskeys, but some are very good, I must say.
I know my thought has always been, if I wanted to drink wine, I'd drink wine. If I want to drink whiskey, I'll drink whiskey.
I agree. If you have the whiskey and the wine that are together but not mingled together, it's like a premix, I would say.
Yeah. You're one of the three leaders in the Malt Maniacs competition each year in terms of actually organizing these whiskeys. And one of the things I've noticed over the last few years, and I know you have as well, is the growth of whiskeys from outside Scotland, outside the traditional countries. We've seen some very interesting whiskeys being produced all over the world. Is that one of the really good things we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years, is more people producing whiskeys that you would never have expected to see otherwise?
Oh, yes, of course. It's globally, I'm sure it's a very good thing, because first it pushes the Scots a bit, maybe the Americans. I don't know much about bourbon, sadly, but I will try to work on that. It's true that, you know, actually you have two kinds of whiskeys from let's say, the rest of the world, as the Scots say, I used to say, the rest of the world, either they try to copy, to mimic what the Scots do, which can be fantastic. The Japanese did that, most of the Japanese, not all of them, but, and then you have fantastic Yamazakis or Hakushus or Migayiko and so on. And others try to, in other countries, for instance, in the Eastern European countries or I think America as well, they are trying to put something which is local into the whiskey. And or McMira in Sweden, it doesn't taste like Scotch. So at first, it's quite, I would say, disturbing to taste these whiskies because you're looking for something which is Scotch-like. But then when you go back to these whiskies, you start to like them, and there are many new styles. And this is a very good thing.
Let me put you on the spot. Which distillers are doing things right?
The ones who survive and the ones who are thriving, you know. Sometimes we as amateur whiskey or as whiskey enthusiasts, we tend to assimilate or to talk about the whiskey, say these guys are not doing right, these guys are doing wrong or whatever. But these guys have to sell whiskey to survive, and if it works, it works. Let's not forget that the market is really subdivided in between different categories. We, whiskey enthusiasts, maybe we won't drink, of course, this whiskey because we think it's average. But if it sells, it's just fine. What we need is as many distilleries as possible, which is a good thing. We would better not see one day some mega huge distilleries and no more small ones. So let's just support all of them, as long as they don't sell it for too much money. That's the problem.
And that's the other thing we've seen, is the cost of whiskey is going up for we consumers, right?
Yes, yes. Well, actually...
Does it bother you when a distillery comes out with this one-off bottling with 50 or so bottles and they sell it for $20,000 or 15,000 euros a bottle? Does that really bother you?
Not really. It's a marketing stunt. They are trying to create a halo effect, you know. I don't know if you say halo or halo in English, but, you know, the trick is very easy. Because I sell a whiskey, 40 years old or 50 years old whiskey, for so much money, that means that the brand name is very good. So all my whiskeys are very good, so please buy my 10 years old, you know. It's just the trick. Of course, it's sometimes a bit, the whiskey has to be good, but usually it is. But of course, I won't buy a bottle of I've tasted the new Highland Park, 50 years old. I think the price is tremendously high, but the whiskey is great. So, of course, I won't buy a bottle because I just don't have the money. But if I had the money, maybe I would buy one, you know?
One of those things, if you win the lottery, you buy a bottle of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If I win the lottery, maybe I would buy one. Yeah, sure.
What one bottling that you've judged over the last few years and scored on, would you not only not buy a bottle of it, but if somebody gave you a bottle of it, you'd find a way to give it away to somebody else because it's just that bad?
There are many, I guess. I think I won't quit. Oh, yeah. I tried wine whiskey from a wee country in Europe that was really, really bad. And it was black, by the way. It was black because I don't know if they patched the casks with nails or whatever. The whiskey got really black and opaque, you know. You really, it was like if it was coal in water, and the whiskey was ugly. But I won't tell you the name because anyway, you won't find the whiskey in the market. So,
and it's not Loch Doo.
It's not. No, it's not Loch Doo. No.
When we talk about a black whiskey, that's the one everybody thinks of, but it wasn't that one, right?
Yeah, a lot of people talk about Loch Doo, but not many people tried Loch Doo. Actually, some people like it. I know some people like it, which is quite funny. But I don't like it. But
nor do I. But. I have to also ask you, because Whiskey Fun is more than just whiskey, because with the help of folks like Nick Morgan, you also do a lot of music features as well. And in that respect, it's more than just whiskey. It's almost like a lifestyle thing. Where did the interest in music come from?
I can't tell you. You know, we all bought the first records when we were 15 years old. I think it's the same thing for you. And I think I could even easily live without whiskey. I couldn't live without music, you know. So music is really important. I never wanted to do a website that would be strictly, you know, whiskey or strictly anything. It's not a commercial one, so I really don't care. I just publish what I like. which is music and whiskey. So maybe if one day I like something else, maybe I would talk about that. Of course, many people will write to me and say, hey, stop this madness. But I know it's all very unlikely. But, well, I'm just trying to have fun myself.
And how did you get Nick Morgan to write concert reviews for you?
Well, actually, he's such a great music lover. He knows a lot about music. I think he worked in the music industry at some point as well. He's a huge blues guitarist, excellent blues and rock and roll guitarist. He knows music very much, and he writes English much, much better than me, of course, because he is English first, and second, his English is brilliant. So I thought it was an easy way to improve the level of the English on the website to have an English guy writing about something, because my English is quite weak, you know.
Yeah, why did you decide to do the site in English instead of French?
Good question. I don't know, maybe to try to improve my English by doing the website or something, I don't know. Oh, I thought because I already had some friends from other countries, and I thought if I want this guy to understand what I write, I'd better write it in English.
The other thing that Whiskey Fun is known for, the team of Pete and Jack, the cartoon characters that often comment in rather scathing terms about whiskeys these days. How did Pete and Jack come to be?
I always liked to draw, to do some drawings when I was younger, and I thought it would be funny. You know, I used to work in the publishing business a long time ago, and we used to do magazines, and we used to have cartoons, and I even like, you know, these small cartoons in the Herald Tribune or Dilbert or all these guys. So I thought it would be nice to have one on the website as well, a small cartoon from time to time.
And it gives you a way to comment on things in the whiskey industry, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. That's the fun of it. It's to let these guys talk instead of me. Yeah, that's right.
Let's go through one of those cartoons from a couple of weeks ago when there were rumors about distilleries all over Isla being sold and traded. And I'll ask you to sort of go through the way Pete and Jack explained that.
One of the guys said there are rumors about some sales going on in the industry, and I've heard that, I think it was LVMH sold Ardbeg to Bruichladdich, and Bruichladdich resold Ardbeg to Diageo, who resold it to LVMH. So the same company had again, and actually when you were reading the websites or the forums or the blogs, that's what happened, actually. Yeah. Some guys were saying, yes, you just worked on all those rumors, and it just didn't make sense, because it was meaning that the company owning the distillery was still owning the distillery.
And as Pete's going through this, Jack is rolling his eyes.
Yeah.
To the music point for a second, I got to ask where you come up with some of the eclectic songs that you put on there, because I will give you credit, you've expanded my musical horizons, because I've downloaded and discovered some artists that I've heard about after seeing them on your site. Where do you find all these eclectic music or musicians to put on the site?
Oh, you know, with through the years, quite some musicians started to write to me. I've got quite some records as well, CDs, even old LPs that I try to put in MP3, or just musicians that I know. You know, when I always like jazz, I always especially avant-garde jazz and stuff like that. So what's sure is that I try not to talk about musicians that are very famous, rather low-key musicians, but they, in my view, that would deserve a much higher recognition.
And they're not just doing songs about whiskey.
They are not, I'm afraid, no.
But, I mean, it's all sorts of music, literally from Brazilian jazz to American blues to all sorts of fun things.
Yes, right. Yeah. American blues, yeah. This is one of my favorites, of course. And of course, jazz. Jazz came from America, so there are probably 50% of American musicians on the website, yeah.
WhiskeyFun.com is probably one of the most popular whiskey websites. I know you get over 1 million visitors a year. Are you surprised by the success this has had?
I'm quite surprised. You know, I started very early, as you said. So I'm 100% sure that the fact that I started early makes makes it maybe a bit more successful than others. It's much easier when you're there since a long time to get many visitors than of course if you start just now. At the time, I think it was the only one, and there was Johannes's Malt Madness blog as well. But we had the two only whiskey blog, I think, in English at least.
Where do you take it from here? How far do you see expanding Whiskey Fun? How long do you see yourself doing it, even?
I don't know. Maybe I'll stop when it's 10 years old. This was my thought. At some point, I said to myself, maybe I'll just stop it when it's 10 years old. And maybe I will do it. I don't know yet, but maybe. We'll see.
You realize we're not going to let you stop doing it at 10 years old.
Maybe I'll sell it to Diageo, or I don't know. No, I'm joking. Nobody would buy that. Of course not. But I don't know. Maybe I'll stop. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll stop talking about whiskey and start talking about, I don't know what, wine, tequila, whatever. Change the subject or something. I don't know. I have no limits. I mean, I can do what I want. And I have no advertising or anything. So I have no obligation. So whatsoever.
And one of the things you don't do, other than a column for Whiskey Magazine France, is write about whiskeys in other publications when you easily, if you wanted to, could be one of the world's leading whiskey writers. Why not?
First, because I think that the writers that are already here, there, Dave Broom, Charlie MacLean, Martin Way, or John Hansel, these guys are very good, much better than I am, let's be honest. First, the English makes sense, mine doesn't sometimes. And I don't feel like going in this field, and it's not my job, so I have to work as well to earn my money so that I can buy some bottles, you know. So I won't do it. I won't do it. Maybe one day publish some tasting notes or something, very easy to do because I have so many. So, but writing whole articles, I don't think I will do it.
Could you see yourself writing a book someday?
I don't think so. I don't think I will have the time to do it. No. Many people have asked me already, but I have no time for that. No.
What is the highest score you've ever given to a whiskey?
I think it was 98. 98, if I remember well, and I think it was for an old Springbank. I will have to check, actually. I can't remember exactly. I think it was an old Springbank, 12 years old, a cask strength for Samaroli in Italy, something like that.
Is there a distillery yet that you have not been able to try a whiskey from?
Not in Scotland. Not an active one, for sure. But of course, there are many closed distilleries that I would love to try. I mean, distilleries that have been closed a long time ago, such as Malt Mill, Parkmore, Ostermusti, you know, these strange names that we can read in some in Barnard's book, you know. Of course, I would kill somebody to be able to try these whiskies. We try them. We all try them in old blends, but of course not as single, so it's difficult to know how they were tasting.
We lost a lot of distilleries over the last 30 years because of the Whiskey Lake and other issues. Which distillery of the closed ones that we've lost over that last 30 to 50 years would you love to get reopened again? If you could pick one, which one would you go for?
Well, probably Brora. Probably Brora. No question about that. Yeah, Brora for sure.
Why?
I think, you know, when you try the whiskey, I mean, the story is nice. And the whiskey is fantastic. It was a whiskey that was, especially in the early 70s, it was a whiskey that was made like an Islay. The aim of the whiskey was to mimic an Islay in a certain way for the blends. And I think they did it so well that the whiskey was actually better than an Islay at the time. So, but I don't know if they distilled a lot, but the ones that we could try from 71, 72, or even 1970 were such brilliant whiskeys. Yeah, so I'd love to do that. But I think it's really a dream because I don't think anybody will be able to buy the distillery. I've heard that it's not sellable. They won't sell it, so anyway, let's not dream about that.
Any others?
Well, any others? Yes, probably Glenugie. I love this whiskey. Lochside as well. And probably many others. Portland, maybe.
That's the one that comes up often as an answer to that question, which one would love to have back if you could go back to 1983 and stop the people in charge at the time at DCL from shutting all those distilleries down. But I'm surprised that it wasn't your first pick, because that's the one most people talk about they'd love to get back.
Yeah, it's the peat effect, you know, because it was a peaty whiskey. If Portland wasn't peated, I'm not sure anybody would talk about Portland anymore. So I think it's the peat. It's a great whiskey. It can be a great whiskey. Some were fantastic. But I prefer Brough Rye, I must say, yeah.
How did you develop your nose for whiskey?
Oh, it's extremely easy to do. You just have to taste a lot of whiskey. Just taste and nose a lot of whiskey, a lot of different whiskeys, and your brain will just do the work for you. You know, you can't do anything else. It's just like anything. You just train by trying a lot of whiskeys. And I always tell people, just try, and you will just learn. It's very easy, actually. You just have to be exposed to many whiskeys, and it'll come, except if you don't have any nose. But any people can do it.
One of the things that you and some of the other maniacs do every year, or in off years, after the awards are handed out, is take some whiskeys that have been distilled and then produce what's affectionately referred to as the Big Bastard. And actually take single malts and redistill them all together. I got to have you tell me about this, because I've never had the luck yet to taste one of these things, but tell me about the process for putting together the Big Bastard.
Actually, Mark, we did it only once yet, but we will do it again this year. Every year I rent a still, which is a small pot still, 100 liters pot still, copper pot still, that you can rent in Alsace, where I live. It's legal to rent such a still. And
it's the same still a lot of the farmers use for making Armagnacs and things like that, right?
Not exactly. It's rather German. It's German style. It's a pot still, but German style. Okay. It's made to distill eau de vie, a fruit eau de vie.
Okay.
But it's not continuous. It's a pot still. So usually I distill fruit every year, one day with some friends. It's a tradition since quite a lot of years, 25 years. And every once in a while I keep my leftovers from bottles or indeed from the awards, there can be some, from samples, and I just mix everything and redistill it. I call it a re-single malt whiskey. I'm not quite sure it's a single malt. I don't know if the fact that it's been distilled in one single still at a time makes it a single malt, even if all the previous ingredients were from 100 different distilleries. I don't know. And we call that the Big Bastard, yeah.
What does it usually wind up tasting like?
Well, I think I did a mistake. I left it too long in the wooden cask that I used. It was a small, we call, like a quarter cask. Mm-hmm. It was a full quarter cask, but it was very active. So after only 1 year, the whiskey was already almost, you know, golden. I mean, even amber. And it was already a bit too woody for my tastes. But I did send it to the Malt Maniacs Awards last year, and I think it got a solid bronze, so I was quite happy.
And, of course, that was completely anonymous, and nobody knew what it was.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah, it was 100% blind. So actually defeated quite some Scots.
Which I'm sure had some of the Scots really happy about that one.
I can't even remember if we published these results. I'm not quite sure if we did put the results on the websites for this whiskey. I'm not quite sure.
On the competition, is it fair to say, and I know you have a bias in this because you're one of the organizers of it, that the Malt Maniacs competition is probably the most neutral one there is, because the distillers don't pay anything to enter. All they have to do is send bottles, and the judging is all blind, and the Maniacs pay for shipping to the samples all over the world so that each of the 12 judges can sample them. Is it fair to say this is probably the most unbiased of the whiskey contests?
Tricky question. I know some other competitions are very serious as well. The one that's done by Whiskey Magazine, I think it's very nice as well. They do it really right, because I was on the panel last year. Mm-hmm. I was a judge, and they did it really well. They even did something great, which was to send the same sample twice, blind, so
right.
Which we don't do, but maybe we'll do that one day. That means that one taster tastes the same whiskey twice, but not on the same day. which is even better because to check your consistency when trying, you know. So I wouldn't say we are the only ones. And I wouldn't
Nor
say
would I.
We are the best ones. But we certainly try to do it well because, of course, first, we don't taste together, which is very important. If you taste whiskey together with friends, of course, you're influenced and doesn't quite work. Secondly, it's completely blind indeed, so we don't know about which whiskey, which sample, which whiskey it is, but we don't know if it's from Islay or not. We don't know the ABV. We know nothing about the whiskey. We just know that it's whiskey, so which is 100% blind. Sometimes you have some competitions who organize it, but it's not actually blind because you know that it's a Highlander, that it's got more than 20 years old, that it's 43% and so on. So it narrows down quite a bit. So it's, I would call that 50% blind. And we do it 100% blind. That's true, yeah.
Or it can come from a country that you know only has one distillery, which pretty much makes it obvious.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right, yeah. Yeah, or the category, you know, Skye whiskey, you know. Yeah, it's a Skye. This whiskey is a Skye. Oh, right.
It's pretty simple at that point because there's one distillery that fits that qualification. What's the best whiskey you've tasted this year?
The best whiskey I tasted this year, I think it was a rum.
Okay.
No, I'm joking. But actually, I tried a fantastic rum, an Albion, that I really loved, Demerara. But there were several whiskeys. Whiskey that really impressed me are old Caperdonish or Glen Grants or Strathylas. First, because they are brilliant. And second, because they are really fairly priced. And I think this is getting important, that whiskey is fairly priced. I never take prices into consideration, but if you ask this question, I would say these whiskies. You know, buy some well-known independent bottlers in Scotland, Gordon MacPhail and Duncan Taylor, for instance, who are doing great jobs by keeping the prices really low for what the whiskies are. And I would say these whiskies.
Was it a shame to lose Caperdonic this year? We finally lost it with the sale of the plant to Forsyth's and the decision to close that distillery forever. Was that a big loss?
I don't know. We're talking about the old Caperdonics. I don't quite know the young ones. I've tried some. I've tried some peated ones that were quite good. But, a loss is always sad. A loss is always sad. And Caperdonic sure did make some great whiskey, that's for sure. Yeah.
In closing, you've said that you might shut down this site after 10 years, but what would it take to keep you going after that 10 years? Because a lot of whiskey nuts around the world love reading your site every day.
I don't know. Maybe I'll find, you know, a youngster, a young guy who would take over, you know, simply. I would say, okay, now it's Whiskey Fun by John Smith, and that's all. Why not? But this is my idea, but I'm not 100% sure that I will do it. I don't know. I will see. Or maybe I'll wait until I retire. And when I retire, then it's going to be big.
Of course, there's a link to the Whiskey Fun website at the WhiskeyCast website. Serge also maintains the War on Whiskey Fakes site as well. Now let's start the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of the whiskeys I tried at Friday night's tasting in Philadelphia, the Isle of Arran 13-year-old bottled under the Lochheim label. As you might guess from the name, it is certified kosher, and the 13-year-old age statement has a tongue-in-cheek flavor, too. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The use of bourbon barrels exclusively gives it a nose of vanilla, oak, and dark chocolate. The taste is spicy with cinnamon, nutmeg, pears, and a hint of brown sugar, and the finish is long and peppery with a hint of vanilla. I'm scoring the Lochheim Isle of Arran 13-year-old an 84. Now, Cutty Sark has been languishing in obscurity for a number of years now, but that's more of a marketing issue than a whiskey issue, and the new owners, Edrington Group, are working on the marketing issue side. In the meantime, I opened up a sample of the Cutty Sark 18-year-old this week. It's another reason why you should not turn your nose up at blended scotches. The nose had notes of campfire smoke, dried leaves, dried oranges and pears, caramel and licorice. The taste very well balanced with no rough edges, a nice sherry cask note, toffee and molasses. The finish has a good mix of tartness and sweetness with charred oak, vanilla and caramel notes. It's a very underrated whiskey. I'm giving the Cutty Sark 18-year-old a 92.
Back in Paris, we heard from Aberlour's Ann Miller about the 15-year-old Cuvée Marie de Cosse bottling for the French market. I brought home a small sample for proper evaluation. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is dried fruits, orange peel, figs, and cocoa. The taste is full-bodied and rich, with orange peel, mango, vanilla, and ginger notes. The finish has a nice balance of honey, ginger, and orange peel. I can only say magnifique, and I wish I'd brought home a full bottle of it. I'm scoring the Aberlour 15 Cuvée Marie de Cosse a 93. Of course, you can find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast iPhone app, sponsored by the Glenrothes, and watch soon for an upgrade to the iPhone app, as well as the new Android version sponsored by Ben Romick. The notes are also available at the WhiskeyCast website, where you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the first ever listener survey that I hope you'll take part in, my photo gallery, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.